Hello, I'm Gail Kern-Pastor, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Welcome to our podcast of A Wonderful Evening at the Folger, the 2010 Shakespeare's Birthday Lecture. This lecture, from April 26, 2010, features noted scholar Jonathan Bate speaking on the good life in Shakespeare. His exploration of the Epicurean tradition in such Shakespeare plays as Measure for Measure, The Winter's Tale, and As You Like It makes for fascinating food for thought and is a worthy addition to the Folger tradition of hosting a lecture in honor of Shakespeare's birthday each year. That tradition extends back to the very founding of the library when Folger director Joseph Quincy Adams spoke on Shakespeare and American culture in 1932 and includes my own 1994 lecture, Heat-Seeking Missiles, Shakespeare, Women, and the Caloric Economy in Early Modern England. And now, onto the podcast. Let's join the event in progress just after Jonathan Bate has been introduced.
It's an enormous pleasure to be back at the Folger. I was last here 15 years ago on fellowship, and I loved living on Capitol Hill, even though we made the mistake of arriving in August and having to dive between air-conditioned buildings. So it's lovely to be here in the springtime, albeit briefly. I'm one of those people who only really understands what my books are about when I've finished them and gone on to the next one, which is perhaps rather unfortunate. This lecture is, in a sense, a kind of epilogue to my Soul of the Age book, which had the subtitle out here, A Biography of the Mind of William Shakespeare. I wanted to really try to think about what Shakespeare thought, what Shakespeare believed. And I think I was beginning to get towards an answer at the end, but I didn't quite crack it. So I hope I've sort of finally cracked it here. I want to ask this evening, what did Shakespeare really value? What did he imagine were the principles of a good life, a well-lived life? In the year 306 BC, a man named Epicurus took up residence in Athens. He was an enemy of Platonism. He bought a house and a little garden, and he cultivated his pupils there. He argued against the idea, shared by Plato and Aristotle, that happiness and the good life were linked to active citizenship. Epicurus suggested instead, and Washington is perhaps a good place to be saying this, that political ambition leads only to misery. Instead, we need to find inner happiness. And our models for finding true happiness are to be discovered by looking at the cycles of birth and decay in nature, in that garden. We need to accept the mortality of all things. We need to seek peace of mind, inner tranquility. And we find this by discovering the true nature of things. The true nature of things are as follows. All that exists are atoms and the void. The soul is mortal. There is no such thing as divine providence. The gods do not intervene in human affairs. We should overcome our fear of death and the unknown through the knowledge that there is no afterlife. We have nothing to fear because when we die, all that happens is that our atoms are dispersed back into the cosmos. Philosophy, says Epicurus, means a cultivation of the good life. And the good life is achieved through the cultivation of pleasure. The word he used was hedone, from the Greek hedus, which means sweet, the sweet or good life. Now, of course, this idea of hedonism, in subsequent centuries has been much frowned upon. We associate the word with the indulgence of our appetites. And if you think of the idea of the Epicurean in the context of the drama of Shakespeare's age, probably the first character who will come to your mind is Sir Epicure Mammon in Ben Jonson's comedy, The Alchemist, a huge man whose life revolves around food and sex. That, however, is not what Epicurus was recommending when he told us to pursue the good life. He argued instead that the chief virtue that we should cultivate is friendship. It is friendship that provides us support in time of need. Epicurus suggests that the basis of human relations should be good conversation, because conversation embodies friendship. We should cultivate an agreeable personality. The Roman philosopher Cicero rather liked that idea. He wrote of suavitas, the idea, Cicero says, that an Epicurean way of being is to be agreeable. And sometimes the agreeable Epicurean was contrasted to the supercilious Platonist, the dour Stoic, and the boorish Cynic. The Epicurean shows consideration for others, is ruled by honesty and by non-aggression, and above all has a particular hatred of flattery, of sycophants, of parasites. Epicureanism believes in patience in the present, hope for the future, and gratitude for the past. Life, according to this way of living, must be lived in the present. Ingratitude is a special demon, corrosive of the soul. And as I said at the outset, whereas Aristotle says that the cultivation of civic virtue is the basis of philosophy, Aristotle, remember, says that we are political animals, someone who is not political, not interested in civic life, is an idiot. Epicurus replies by saying, well, maybe I'm a kind of radical idiot because I reject the political life. The principal doctrines of Epicurus were embodied in a series of maxims that were much quoted in classical times, 40 of them. I'll just quote a few of them to give you a flavour of his ideas. Number one, a blessed and indestructible being has no trouble himself and brings no trouble upon any other being, as long as he is free from anger and partiality, for all such things imply weakness. Two, death is nothing to us, for that which has been dissolved into its elements experiences no sensations, and that which has no sensation is nothing to us. Five, it is impossible to live a good life without living wisely and honourably and justly, and it is impossible to live wisely and honourably and justly without living pleasantly. Seven, some men want fame and status, thinking that they would thus make themselves secure against other men. If the life of such men really were secure, they would have attained a natural good. If, however, as it is insecure, they have not attained the end which by nature's prompting they sought. Eight, no pleasure is a bad thing in itself, but the things which produce certain pleasures entail disturbances many times greater than the pleasures themselves. 14. Protection from other men, secured to some extent by material prosperity, is in its purest form derived from a quiet life withdrawn from the multitude. 15. The wealth required by nature is limited and easy to procure. The wealth required by vain ideals is never satisfied. 22. Of all the means which wisdom acquires to ensure happiness throughout the whole of life, by far the most important is friendship. And 31, natural justice is a pledge of reciprocal benefit to prevent one man from harming or being harmed by another. Now, the Roman philosopher Seneca was a great admirer of Epicurus. In one of his epistles, he expressed particular admiration for that garden where Epicurus said, here our supreme good is pleasure, and yet where guests were only given bread and water. Cicero, another important Roman philosopher, followed Epicurus in arguing for the importance of pleasure as an aspect of life, and defined pleasure as the absence of pain, and went from there to argue that the basis of social life should be not inflicting pain on others. In that we get, an origin of that idea of negative liberty, that the basis on which liberty and justice should be built is not inflicting pain on other people, not causing harm to other people. But the Roman writer who did most to develop the ideas of Epicurus and to ensure that they survived through the centuries was the poet Lucretius, whose long philosophical poem, De Rerum Naturae, of the nature of things, was a poetic exposition of the Epicurean system. Now, for a long time, through the Middle Ages and into the early modern period, and towards Shakespeare's time, The Epicurean system, as summed up in the poem of Lucretius, was generally regarded with hostility because of its clear atheism, the idea that there are only atoms and the void, an atheistic idea, and also because of its purported hedonism. In the Middle Ages and the early part of the Renaissance, there were only a few isolated defenders of Epicurus. One, Cosma Raimondi, an early 15th century humanist from Cremona in Italy, endorsed the view that the supreme good lies in pleasure, both of the mind and of the body. He suggested that nature has given us a variety of sense organs precisely so we can enjoy pleasure in all its forms. And obviously that's an idea that would have been abhorrent to a Christian society. Scientific revival of Epicurus is again seen as something that belongs to the late 17th century. So, as far as I'm aware, no critic has argued that Shakespeare could have been an Epicureanism. And there's a general view that Epicureanism was, as I say, frowned upon or indeed not much known about in Shakespeare's time. But that's the view that I want to challenge for you tonight. And my starting point in doing so comes from something that I observed when I was sort of thinking about what Shakespeare's philosophical inclinations were when working on the final chapters of my book, Soul of the Age, where I identified what I thought was a persistent pattern in Shakespeare, where he's very critical of the philosophy of Stoicism, which was extremely popular, extremely widely held in the late 16th century. The Stoic idea, the British Empire was built upon it, the idea of the stiff upper lip, the idea that we need, in Roman fashion, to subdue our emotions, to live according to our reason, that if we control our emotions, if we live as rational beings, then in that case, whatever fortune throws at us, we can survive. The Stoical idea. But Shakespeare was an anti-Stoic. You see this from right at the beginning of his career in his Roman tragedy, Titus Andronicus. The most appalling things happen to Titus. His daughter is raped, her hands are cut off, her tongue is cut out, his son's heads are cut off. And his brother Marcus, who's a very good Roman Stoic, tells him to have patience. That's what the Stoical Roman does. But Titus does not have patience. If we repress our emotions, eventually they will explode within us. Another key aspect of Stoicism was the idea that we should cultivate our reason, cultivate our minds, cultivate our book learning, and subdue the desires of our body. At the beginning of Shakespeare's early comedy, Love's Labour's Lost, four young men set up an academy, a little academe, and that is precisely their project. For 3 years, they are going to renounce the bodily desires to eat and to have sex and devote themselves entirely to learning. It's a model of the university life, as imagined in Shakespeare's time. But of course, within a matter of minutes, some very lovely girls have come along, they fall in love, and as is always the case in Shakespeare, the clown, the fool, is there to give them true wisdom and to say it is the nature of human being to hearken after the flesh. The body intrudes. We cannot deny the reality of bodily desires. That train of thought is precisely the Epicurean response to the Stoic idea that only the mind matters. Or again, you see this critique of Stoicism in Much Ado About Nothing. The scene where Leonardo is in despair because his daughter has been accused of sexual infidelity to her fiancé on the very night before their marriage. His brother, Antonio, comes along and tells him to have patience. And Leonardo says, yeah, philosophers, they're always telling us to have patience. But was there ever yet philosopher that could endure the toothache patiently, however they may pish at chance? In other words, however much the philosopher says, never mind what chance is to happen to me, I have my mind, my reason to keep everything under control. But if the philosopher suffers from toothache, from bodily pain, there's nothing they can do about it. Epicureanism could perhaps be defined as the philosophy that involves an element of Stoicism, but with an acknowledgement of the body added in. And in Shakespeare's plays, again and again, the body and its emotions, its desires, are there to question those who think that life can simply be kept in check through the processes of the reason. Well, the obvious question you're going to ask me is, if you're saying that Shakespeare had this Epicurean vein of thinking, where did he get it from? I think there are a number of answers to that question. He certainly wouldn't have got it from Epicurus's original writings. Most of those were lost in the mists of antiquity, but his ideas were transmitted through the Romans. So, for instance, Horace, probably the most widely read, the most influential of all the Roman poets in Shakespeare's time, Horace specifically says in one of his epistles that he is, as he puts it, a hog from Epicurus' herd. Among Horace's key ideas are the notion of the idea that we can achieve a good life through a pursuit of what Horace calls otium. Otium, a kind of peace, a kind of ease. Otium in Horace is the opposite of nec otium. In Latin, the word nec is a negative prefix. It means not. Nec otium becomes negotium, from which we get negotiation. Nec otium, negotium means business. Whenever we fly and we are asked business or pleasure, we are being given the choice that Horace is fascinated in, the choice between otium, ease or pleasure, on the one hand, negotium, business, on the other. And Horace felt, following Epicurus, that the idea that we can achieve happiness through pursuing negotium, through pursuing a life of business and politics, not true. True happiness to be found in otium. As he puts it in one of his famous odes, he lives happily on a little, on whose frugal table shines the ancestral salt dish, and whose soft slumbers are not carried away by fear or sordid greed. It is fruitless, Horace suggests, to strive for great possessions, great fame, political preferment. And the other idea that Horace gets from Epicurus, a very famous Horatian idea, the notion that we must live in the moment, as he puts it at the climax of one of his other odes, dum loquimur fugerit invida aetas, carpe diem, quam minimum credula postero. Even while we speak, envious time has passed. Pluck the day, putting as little trust as possible in tomorrow. Those Horatian ideas run throughout the drama and poetry of Shakespeare's time. Ben Jonson, Shakespeare's friend and rival, thought of himself as a kind of modern Horace, represented himself as Horace in his play Poetaster. But we also find Epicurean thought in some of the other poet dramatists. I was particularly interested recently to discover a rather obscure, difficult, but very interesting poem by George Chapman, another very important, rather understudied dramatist of the time. This is a poem of his called Eugenia, in other words, a poem about good breeding. I mean, I suppose eugenics we get from that. A poem subtitled True Nobility's Trance, in which Chapman writes, "Learn to love truly good and honest things, and you shall find there wealth and honor springs, enabling you a private path to tread." In other words, it's the private life, not the public life, where we find happiness. The art of the good life, says Chapman in this poem, requires us to accept, as he puts it, that our bodies have means to endue their powers with carnal loves. The flesh is given a liver that forms love, and hath not she in all her powers one Christ-blessed faculty to be her liver to inform his love? So Chapman arguing, contrary to the Christian idea, that a Christian idea of love is in opposition to a notion of bodily love, that Christian opposition between agape and eros, contrary to that, that physical love, sexual love, is part of the good life. But above all, I think Shakespeare derived a sense of the Epicurean philosophy from the reading, which began halfway through his career, of the essays of the great French essayist Michel de Montaigne. In 1603, Shakespeare's friend John Florio published an English translation of Montaigne, and it's very, very clear Shakespeare read this book closely. His vocabulary is deeply influenced by Florio's Montaigne, and there are two, at least, very famous passages in The Tempest that are close translations of passages in Florio's Montaigne. Throughout his essays, Montaigne had meditated, as Shakespeare does throughout his plays, on the value and the limitation of the Stoic resolve to bear misfortune patiently. However much you are in control of your mind, Montaigne remarks in his essay Of Constancy, you can't stop yourself from trembling if a gun goes off in your ear, or from going tense and pale if a building collapses beside you. So that bodily sensation, a bodily response to physical experience, is an essential part of experience. That is the thing, Montaigne says, that is the missing element in both the Stoic faith in the pure power of the mind to control the self and St. Paul's dualistic separation of the immortal soul from the mortal or self-mortified body. The true route to happiness, says Montaigne, may require us to be more relaxed and flexible than either Seneca or St. Paul would allow. We must not cleave so fast unto our humours and dispositions. Our chiefest sufficiency is to apply ourselves to diverse fashions. It is a being but not a life to be tied and bound by necessity to only one course. The goodliest minds are those that have most variety and pliableness in them. That's Montaigne. Variety and pliableness, the distinction between a being and a life, the difference between mere being and a fully lived life, a good life. If Shakespeare's copy of Florio's translation of Montaigne were ever to be found, I'm sure it would be bought by the Folger, but if it were to be found, that is the kind of sentence that I'm sure would have been heavily underlined or annotated with a marginal tick or a remark such as true wisdom. This way of thinking in Montaigne was shaped above all by Epicurus, who lived out his beliefs in that philosophical community known as the Garden, to which scandalously women and slaves were admitted. As I've said, most of Epicurus's voluminous original writings are lost, but they were transmitted to the Romans and thence to the Renaissance via their poetic working in Lucretius. De Rerum Natura, perhaps the greatest philosophical epic poem ever written, Shakespeare is unlikely to have known it directly, but he would have discovered many quotations from it and meditations on its Epicurean ideas when he read Montaigne. So to reiterate where we've got to, a reader of Lucretius, or Shakespeare reading bits of Lucretius in Montaigne, would have discovered an entirely different worldview from that of Christianity, or indeed Platonism. The universe consisting of nothing but atoms swerving unpredictably in a void. The human being as nothing but a conglomeration of atoms which at death are dispersed back into the universe. No immaterial soul, no immortality, no active God intervening in human affairs. Since death is nothingness, no need for superstition. The good life accordingly achieved through friendship, through kindness to those around you, through the pursuit of pleasure. With the proviso that overindulgence of the appetites will not bring enduring happiness. And that's an important distinction. Epicurus himself and his true followers like Montaigne are not recommending the kind of excessive pleasure embodied in the figure of Sir Epicure Mammon. They're saying that overindulgence of bodily desires is actually a false pursuit of pleasure because it actually brings more pain than pleasure. Would we ever get drunk if we had the hangover beforehand instead of afterwards, says Montaigne. Well, despite that view, Epicureanism was, as I've said, regarded with great suspicion in Shakespeare's time because of its apparent licensing of sensual indulgence and its atheism. A marginal note in the Geneva Bible railed against the Epicures for making a mock and scoff at all religions. And orthodox Elizabethan writers, such as Sir John Davis in his poem Orchestra, which is a long poem imagining the cosmos as a harmonious dance ordained by God, he regarded the Lucretian Epicurean idea of atomic chance as the illusion of a sickened brain. Or if this all which roundabout we see as idle Morpheus some sick brains hath taught, of undivided motes compacted be. That's the atomism, undivided motes. How was this goodly architecture wrought? Or by what means were they together brought? They err that say they did concur by chance. Love made them meet in a well-ordered dance. Now, I'm not saying Please don't go away thinking I am saying that Shakespeare was a proponent of Lucretian atheism or atomism. In Julius Caesar, Cassius does espouse the Epicurean philosophy, whereas Brutus is a Stoic. They're explicit about that. Brutus says, I'm a Stoic. Cassius says, I'm an Epicurean. But when foreboding ravens, crows, and kites hover in place of mighty eagles over the army of Cassius, Cassius interprets that change as a divine sign, and he is therefore forced to modify his Epicurean belief that the gods do not intervene in human affairs. He says, you know that I held Epicurus strong and his opinion. Now I change my mind and partly credit things that do presage. In other words, I now do believe that the gods show us signs of their good or bad will. But notice partly credit there, very typically Shakespearean that. Cassius has not entirely renounced his Epicurean skepticism about omens and auguries. Now, it's true that Shakespeare did sometimes associate Epicureanism with sensual excess in the manner of Ben Jonson's Sir Epicure Mammon. So it is that Goneril condemns King Lear's 100 knights and squires, men so disordered, so debauched and bold, that this our court, infected with their manners, shows like a riotous inn. Epicurism and lust make it more like a tavern or a brothel than a graced palace. And then there is Master Ford condemning fat, lecherous Sir John Falstaff in The Merry Wives of Windsor. What a damned Epicurean rascal is this? Or Macbeth scorning those who have turned against him. Then fly, false thanes, and mingle with the English epicures. And Roman Pompey expressing his disdain for Mark Antony's Egyptian lifestyle with Cleopatra. Epicurean cooks sharpen with cloyless sauce his appetite. But the moment one considers the context of these utterances, Shakespeare's sympathy for the Epicureans becomes apparent. Are we supposed to agree with Goneril, to damn Falstaff, to despise Seward and the other English epicures who help Macduff and Malcolm to rescue bleeding Scotland from the clutches of murderous Macbeth? To prefer Roman austerity to Antony and Cleopatra's gaudy nights? For gluttony, Falstaff is Sir Epicure's match, but with a key difference. To Prince Hal, he embodies the true Epicurean virtue of friendship that he has not found in family or court, but does find in the tavern, the riotous inn. Falstaff embodies friendship every bit as much as he is an eater, a drinker, a deceiver, a self-server, a seeker after pleasure. Shakespeare is often praised for sympathising equally with all his characters. I have praised him thus myself. But did he really? Surely there are some characters with whom Shakespeare fell in love. Falstaff and Cleopatra, eminent among them. And they are the most truly Epicurean characters in all his works. Because like Montaigne, Falstaff and Cleopatra refuse to pretend that there is no such thing as the body. That's really as far as I got in this sort of seed of an idea that Shakespeare might have been an Epicurean there. But I've sort of recently been going back and thinking more about that idea. And I want to push it further now. I want to suggest maybe there is, in fact, a touch of that Epicurean atomism in Shakespeare. I've said that generally the idea that the revival of atomistic Epicurean thought is associated by intellectual historians with the second half of the 17th century, but that's not strictly true. After all, here's John Donne in his great poem, The First Anniversary, that poem with the line, the new philosophy puts all in doubt, written in 1609, or published 1609, probably written a bit earlier. The world, Donne says there, crumbled out again to his atomies. So if we look back at Macbeth, we find Macbeth speaking to the wayward, weird sisters, the idea of the world of nature made of atoms, of seeds. Same idea is in King Lear, when he's in the storm, crack nature's moulds, all germens spill at once that make ingrateful man. Or Florizel in The Winter's Tale, let nature crush the sides of the earth together, and mar the seeds within. Now, the idea of the composition of the of nature out of seeds, I mean, that's an idea that comes from classical mythology. It's not exclusively Epicurean, but as I say, it's moving towards an Epicurean philosophy. And in the second half of Shakespeare's career, once he's read Montaigne, who quotes Lucretius, Lucretius's Epicurean poem, over 100 times, we begin to find statements and sentences that are more strictly, more philosophically Epicurean. One of Lucretius's key lines, it's quoted by Montaigne, is nil posse creare de nihilo. Nothing can be made out of nothing. Scandalous view in Christian culture, contrary to the Orthodox Christian view that God did make the world out of nothing. But Lucretius, Epicurus say, no, nothing can be made out of nothing. And it's, of course, very soon after reading that in Montaigne that King Lear says precisely that, nothing can be made out of nothing to Cordelia. And it seems to me, stepping back, regardless of the question of the direct influence of Epicurus on Shakespeare, the extent to which he might have been aware of the Epicurean philosophy, the structure of Shakespeare's journey, both biographically and in his work, is deeply Epicurean. One of the things that's very striking, quite surprising, about Shakespeare's life and what he did with his money is that he never bought property in London until actually very near the end of his life, when he no longer needed property in London, when in 1613 he bought, maybe as a buy-to-let investment property, we don't know, a gatehouse near the Blackfriars Theatre. But if you look at the lives of Shakespeare's fellow actors, and because of the system of the actors being a joint stock company, a shareholding company, sharing the profits of their plays, they actually all got very rich very quickly. But what Shakespeare's fellow dramatists, people like Burbage and Hemings and Condell, Augustine Phillips did, was they bought big houses in nice London suburbs like Fulham and Dulwich. That would have been the obvious thing for Shakespeare to do, but he didn't. He rented property in London. He bought his property back in his hometown in Stratford-upon-Avon. And one of the things I argue in Soul of the Age is that in terms of where Shakespeare was in the second half of his life, from 1604, 1605 onwards, there's much more evidence of his presence in Stratford than in London. That was partly because for a lot of the time in those years, the theatres were closed because of plague. And if there's plague in London, the first thing you're going to want to do is to get out of town. One of the early stories about Shakespeare from someone who visited Stratford-upon-Avon not that long after his death to sort of research his life was that in his youth, Shakespeare was much among the players, but in his later years, he retired to Stratford and wrote one or two plays a year, which he then sent down to the players. And that does cohere with recently discovered evidence, which shows that Shakespeare retired from acting in about 1604, 1605. There's a recently discovered document listing the players of the King's Men who appeared at court in 1608, and Shakespeare is strikingly absent from them. And equally, you find in Ben Jonson's early plays, Shakespeare's in the cast, but Jonson's later plays, he's not in the cast. So he's given up on acting. He's spending more and more time back in Stratford. And he's building the great majority of his investment portfolio in Stratford. He's speculating on the agricultural commodities market. He's buying a lot of property. He's engaging in a lot of litigation. He still goes back to London, and we see him back in London, actually, in 1612, 1613, 1614, the period where he's writing plays in collaboration with John Fletcher and sort of grooming Fletcher to take over the role of playwright for the King's Men. But Shakespeare seems to be being drawn back to Stratford. And if you think of those late plays like Cymbeline and The Winter's Tale, these are plays that are very interested in a movement away from the corrupt court towards the restorative world of the countryside. That pattern of otium against negotium, court versus country, politics versus pleasure, it's everywhere in Shakespeare, right across his genres. King Lear, in a way, offers a journey back to nature. Okay, nature is not a pleasant green place, it's a bleak heath, but it's still a place that is less harmful than the corrupt court with all its flattery. After all, Lear finds that great Epicurean virtue of friendship among the little group of followers who go with him onto the heath and into the hovel. Voluptas, a kind of unhealthy desire, is displaced to the court, to the ambitious characters. And above all, there is the Winter's Tale, with its clear opposition between Sicilia, the place of the court, of the tortured mind, of the reason going out of control, and Bohemia, the place of the country associated with the pleasures of the body. Equally, if we think about that Horatian Epicurean idea of carpe diem, seizing the day, again, we find this everywhere in Shakespeare. Would you have a love song or a song of the good life, Feste asks in Twelfth Night. A love song, says Sir Toby. Aye, says Sir Andrew, I care not for good life. And Feste then sings his love song, Journey's end in lover's meeting, every wise man's son doth know. But then Feste goes on, what is love? 'Tis not hereafter. Present mirth hath present laughter. What's to come is still unsure. In delay there lies no plenty. Then come kiss me, sweet and twenty. Youth, the stuff will not endure. Because youth is a stuff that will not endure, we should seize the day. We should live in the moment. Now, As You Like It, the comedy that Shakespeare wrote in 1599, so it's a little before he's read Montaigne, giving him the sort of more formalized Epicurean philosophy. But it is a play, As You Like It, that I think is very close to Shakespeare's heart. This, after all, is set in the Forest of Arden. Shakespeare was born on the edge of the Forest of Arden. His mother was named Mary Arden, took her name from the forest. And, of course, it's a play where there is a joke by Shakespeare, a joke at his own expense. There is the character of a simple country bumpkin from the Forest of Arden whose name is William, who is mocked by the sophisticated people of the court, just as Shakespeare was mocked by the sophisticated London dramatists, mocked as a countryman, a jack of all trades, an upstart crow, the only Shake scene in the country, mocked for his provinciality when he first came to London. So As You Like It, that return to Arden, perhaps a play very, very close to Shakespeare's heart. And if one thinks of what the Duke says when we see him in exile, early in that play, all these Epicurean ideas seem to come together. Now, my co-mates and brothers in exile, hath not old custom made this life more sweet than that of painted pomp? So the sweet life, you remember I was saying the Epicurean idea of hedonēr comes from the Greek hedis, meaning sweet. The life of exile, the life back with nature, away from the painted pomp, the falseness, the flattery of the court. That's the good life, that's the sweet life. Are not these woods more free from peril than the envious court? Here feel we not the penalty of Adam, the season's difference. As the icy fang and churlish chiding of the winter's wind, which when it bites and blows upon my body, even till I shrink with cold, I smile and say, this is no flattery. These are counsellors that feelingly persuade me what I am. So flattery associated with the court, political ambition that is rejected, the physical sensation of the cold wind on the body, feelingly persuade me what I am. To be truly human requires an acceptance of feeling. Sweet are the uses of adversity, which, like the toad, ugly and venomous, wears yet a precious jewel in his head. And this our life, exempt from public haunt, finds tongues in trees, books in the running brooks, sermons in stones, and good in everything. I would not change it. Exempt from public haunt, the idea that pursuing a public life, that Aristotelian Platonic idea of virtue, the civic life, is clearly rejected. Blow, blow, thou winter wind, goes the song in the play. Thou art not so unkind as man's ingratitude. You remember I said Epicurus said ingratitude is the worst of vices. Most friendship is feigning, most loving mere folly. Then hey-ho, the holly, this life is most jolly. Freeze, freeze, thou bitter sky that dost not bite so nigh as benefits forgot. Though thou the waters warp, thy sting is not so sharp as friend remembered not. And how like you this shepherd's life? Master Touchstone asks Corin, the natural philosopher, the shepherd, to which Touchstone, the embodiment of the philosophy of the court, if you like, says, truly, shepherd, in respect of itself, it is a good life, but in respect that it is a shepherd's life, it is naught. In respect it is solitary, I like it very well. In respect that it is private, it is a very vile life. In respect it is in the fields, it pleaseth me well, but in respect it is not in the court, it is tedious. As it is a spare life, look you, it fits my humour well, but as there is no more plenty in it, it goes much against my stomach. Hast any philosophy in thee, shepherd? And the shepherd, Corin, replies with a philosophy of common sense, that he knows the elements, he knows poverty, he knows the need to work, he knows reality of a grounded, material, physical, bodily sort of a kind that the aspirations and sophistication and hypocrisy of the court doesn't take sufficient cognizance of. And again, the song's always so revealing in Shakespeare. It's in one of the songs in As You Like It, It Was a Lover and His Lass, that we again get that idea of the carpe diem. Therefore, take the present time, for love is crowned with the prime. The end of the play, Jakes, the melancholy philosopher, decides to stay in the woods where the old duke, or rather the new duke, who's expelled once the old duke gets his power back, the new duke has gone into exile and put on a religious life and thrown into neglect the pompous court. The play ends not taking us back to the pompous court. As I said, this movement Shakespeare's so interested in, away from the world of politics, ambition and preferment and the court, back to this world that I'm associating with the Epicurean garden, with the pastoral world, it's there across his literary genres. It's very, very powerful in two of his Jacobean tragedies, which, as I say, may well have been written from Stratford, written from the country rather than the court. One is King Lear, which I've talked about, with this movement out from the court to the heath. But the other is Timon of Athens, a play that Shakespeare seems to have written in collaboration with another dramatist, Thomas Middleton, a dramatist who was actually much more committed to London than Shakespeare was, and that is precisely about the things that Epicurus is interested in. It's a play that begins with an idea of friendship. Timon, fascinating, a character uniquely in Shakespeare who has no family. It's actually a play that imagines a world almost without women. The only women in the play are two prostitutes who come on for about 20 lines. So you know, nearly always in Shakespeare, men are defined by their relationships to family and by the courtship process, the relationship to wives, to lovers, to women. Timon is entirely sort of sets all that aside and explores notions of friendship, the motivations of friendship, and then the rejection of friendship. Because Timon is a very rich man, so he's surrounded by friends. But of course, those friends really prove to be merely flatterers who are only friendly with him because he's rich. When he loses all his money, he loses all his friends. And what he does then is he goes out from Athens and he goes out to the woods. He, in a sense, goes back to nature. But whereas in a comedy like As You Like It, that return to nature achieves this kind of Horatian, Epicurean otium, ease or happiness, what happens in Timon is that he only finds anger when he's there. And it becomes, in many ways, Shakespeare's most angry play. And Epicurus is always telling us that anger is the least healthy of emotions. The other play that I think really sort of comes alive in sort of thinking about this Epicurean motif in Shakespeare, and I shall end with this, is Measure for Measure. In some senses, his last comedy, certainly a comedy that is very dark, very problematic in its conclusion, that is not a happy comedy in the sense of As You Like It with its four marriages. A play written very soon after he's been reading Montaigne. but a play that is rigorous in showing us that we cannot do away with the body. It's a play about two moral extremists who try to do without the body, the puritanical figure of Angelo and the figure of Isabella, who is a novice who wants to be a nun, which is absolutely, you know, mortifying the body, doing away with the desires of the body. But of course, what they both discover is the body. Angelo discovers his desire for Isabella, and Isabella is forced to confront the fact of mortality because of the way that her brother Claudio is condemned to death, and she is asked by Angelo to give her body to him sexually in return for the saving of her brother's body. But it's a play that is full of bodies, full of desires. A prison and a brothel are among its key locations. And this extraordinary character of Barnardine, the prisoner, who in some sense does represent pure body, a pure sense of mortality. But also, fascinatingly, there's a speech in which the Duke in disguise, disguised as a friar, goes to Claudio, who's been condemned to death, and tries to persuade him to accept death, to mortify his body. And the way in which he does this is very interesting. It's partly a traditional Christian language of contemptum mundi, the idea of show contempt for the world, think only of your soul, then you'll be able to think about salvation, prepare yourself for death. But there's another aspect to it, which seems to me much more of an Epicurean reflection on the idea that death is not to be feared because after death there is nothing. It's an extraordinarily paradoxical thing for a so-called friar to be saying. A friar should be preparing the soul for heaven, but the emphasis in this speech appears not to be the soul, but the body. Thy best of rest is sleep, says the disguised Duke to Claudio, and that thou oft provokest, yet grossly fearest, thy death, which is no more. Thou art not thyself, for thou exists on many a thousand grains that issue out of dust. Thou art not thyself, for thou exists on many a thousand grains that issue out of dust. Surely that is the Epicurean idea, that we are merely grains of dust, atoms that come together, and that at death will disperse back into the universe. Happy thou art not, for what thou hast not still thou strivest to get, and what thou hast forgettest. If thou art rich, thou art poor, for like an ass whose back with ingots bows, thou bearest thy heavy riches but a journey, and death unloads thee. Friend, Epicurean idea of friendship again, friend hast thou none, for thine own bowels, which do call thee sire, the mere effusion of thy proper loins, do curse the gout, Serpico, and the rheum for ending thee no sooner. Again, the inexorability of the body and its pains. Thou hast nor youth nor age, but as it were an after-dinner sleep, dreaming on both, for all thy blessed youth becomes as aged and doth beg the arms of palsied eld. And when thou art old and rich, thou hast neither heat, affection, limb, nor beauty to make thy riches pleasant. What's yet in this that bears the name of life? Yet in this life lie hid more thousand deaths, yet death we fear, that makes these odds all even. To which Claudio replies, I humbly thank you, to sue to live, I find I seek to die, and seeking death, find life. Let it come on. Thou hast nor youth nor age, but as it were an after-dinner's sleep, dreaming on both. Perhaps the greatest of all Shakespearean critics was Dr. Samuel Johnson in the 18th century. Johnson, a deeply committed Christian who meditated much and in a very troubled way about his own mortality, his own sin. But Johnson also read Shakespeare clearly. He didn't impose his own beliefs onto Shakespeare. Yet at the same time, he saw perhaps in Shakespeare, as we all do, when we read Shakespeare sensitively and sympathetically, he saw through Shakespeare his own faults. Johnson found it very difficult to do what Epicurus recommends, which is to live in the moment, not to worry about the future, not to regret the past, but to live in the moment, to accept the moment, to accept the body, to seek friendship, to seek the kind of good life that I've been outlining in this lecture. And I want to end by quoting what Johnson says about this particular speech, and hope that the after-dinner sleep, which is mentioned in the speech, has not been provoked in you by the sheer tedium of my lecture, but rather that I have stimulated the kind of thought that Johnson has in mind here. When we are young, we busy ourselves in forming schemes for succeeding time and miss the gratifications that are in front of us. When we are old, we amuse the languor of age with the recollection of youthful pleasures or performances, so that our life, of which no part is filled with the business of the present time, resembles our dreams after dinner, when the events of the morning are mingled with the designs of the evening. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. I'm Gail Kern-Pastor, director of the Folger Shakespeare Library. Home to the world's largest Shakespeare collection, the Folger is dedicated to advancing knowledge and the arts. On the web at folger.edu.